Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Please be advised.
Spoiler alert episode. Spoiler.
Please be advised. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Well, spoiler, God. Do it.
It's really?
Kind Come of on, a, let's come in hot.
Kind of a...
Spoiler episode 90. Bird Box and Roma, comedy film nerds.
A doubleheader, spoiler.
Doubleheader. I don't know that we've ever done a doubleheader, but we really wanted to deal with the two movies that are available on Netflix.
Yes.
Roma, we talked about in a regular
And are episode. Actually watchable.
They're all very, they're very watchable. Roma... Please see it on the big screen.
Right.
If you have zero options or opportunities to see it, then at least then watch it on Netflix. And if you do have to watch it at home, do yourself this favor. Turn the lights off. Turn off your phone. Sit and watch the movie and let it really wash over you.
Yes.
Don't just it's not one of those.
Don't check your phone.
Yeah, there's plenty of dumb movies where you can kind of have in the background and do your laundry and check your, you know, have your laptop open or whatever. This movie is a beautiful work of art. But first we're going to talk. So for those of you who've never listened before, this is a spoiler episode. We're going to talk about a lot of key elements of both of these movies, Bird Box and Roma. We're going to talk about the endings, and both of them have very kind of big, severe endings. So if you have not seen either one of these movies, hit pause and go watch them. Or... if you're working the sound and you haven't seen one of them, you got to just suck it.
Yeah.
So,
yep. Not the first time, won't be the last.
How many movies have we ruined for you, Aaron?
No, you really can't ruin a movie for me, even if you tell me the ending. I'm fine.
All right.
All right, good. That's very open-minded.
Very open-minded. So, Bird Box. Now, we talked about this. This is a movie that I kind of felt like was one of the first or not, but it's definitely one of the better Netflix movies. I know that's not saying a lot,
right?
But it really feels like, wow, they actually...
It's like Aquaman for Netflix.
Yeah. Netflix's scripted episodics are Marvel,
yes.
And their feature films are DC.
Pretty much.
I thought that this movie did a really good job. And there was a lot of cool stuff that I enjoyed. Now, our last guest that talked about it last week, there's some stuff that didn't quite work for them.
Right.
And I thought they made compelling points, if you listen to episode 449. Yeah.
And this is definitely a type of movie that requires a suspension of disbelief. Like all horror and, sci-fi and fantasy, of course it does. So the key is, how do you get there? How do you make it believable where a suspension of disbelief feels natural and deserved? Now, this is the kind of movie that I felt did a good job with that. Like, from everything from the setup to the mechanics. Now, there were a couple clunky things where, wait, if A equals B, then does Y, then does B equal C or what? One of the things is, it's never really entirely explained if the creatures have a physical presence or not.
Right.
Because when they're in the car and the proximity sensors go off, it looks like they're getting surrounded at one point. Now, they could only go off if there was an actual physical entity that was there. But then it's later on, it seems like these creatures can only hurt you if you look at them. Whereas...
And they're sort of depicted as just sort of like almost like a smoke or a mist or a...
Well, what happens is when they're around, you get that air fluctuation that rustles the leaves, where you don't actually see the creatures. But then when you look at them, you go mad. Now, it is explained, again, this is a very clunky exposition. One guy that they're trapped in the house with just happens to be writing a book on mythology specifically to this one threat. Yeah.
So convenient.
So there's a couple of things like that. I'm like, there might have been a better way to do that.
Yeah.
But one of them is that you see your worst possible fear, and that's what drives you to kill yourself. However, they also said that, if you're crazy, like they said, the people in the mental institution, they opened their eyes and they saw them. So what it leads to believe is...
Right, because that was the one thing that was sort of a little vague. I didn't have that big of a problem with it. You and some others did.
Right.
Of the fact that there was a group of people that could just... they didn't have to wear blindfolds.
Right.
They could see the monsters, and they were crazy, though, but they were always, they were trying to get everybody to take their blindfolds off, and they always talked in that, like, crazy culty, like, just see it, it's best.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Now, I actually had less of a problem with that, I think, than our guest, and here's the reason, is because you can kind of trace that to a little bit of, like, even mythology, even to the way a virus works. Like, if a virus kills 90% of the population, there's always that 10% that are resistant to it. So you can actually say that, well, then maybe they saw it and they were resistant to it, or they survived. Or the other explanation on a more spiritual, kind of metaphysical and supernatural level is that seeing these creatures does one of two things. It drives you insane and wants you to kill yourself, or you become a servant to the creatures. And if you become a servant to the creatures, you assist them in having other people try to see them. So, which is kind of like a familiar for a vampire. So, like when they have human servants. So, for that explanation, I'm like, okay, well, there's, you know, that kind of makes sense. But again, it's never really explained, like, which that is. That's also part of the kind of the mystery. The only thing that does get revealed is that there are creatures. It is. It's alluded to more supernatural than like an alien invasion, because that seems to be the exposition that's kind of pointing you in that direction, whether it's demons, supernatural spirits, or whatever. But I really got the impression that they kind of wanted to steer away from aliens, and I think I know why. One of them is because of the obvious comparisons to A Quiet Place, where, you know, you have, all right, well, that's sound, this is sight. Like, right. Well, let's try to distinguish ourselves as much as possible from that film. So I was okay with it. I thought it could have been, it was one of those things that could have been smoothed out a little bit more. Like when you do have a mystery and when you have kind of vague rules, like there is a way to kind of rein that in and make it a little more specific. Like even when she's like in the house exploring and then all of a sudden you see the shadow underneath the door, like, okay, well that denotes a physical presence. Like, but you know, now it looks like they can only hurt you if you look at them. Like, they can't physically hurt you unless you look at them.
Well, let's talk about the ending here.
Mm-hmm.
So, the ending, they get to a school for the blind, which right. I thought that was a cool reveal.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're like, the birds warn the sighted when they're near.
Yes, uh-huh. The birds go crazy.
The birds go crazy. Mm-hmm. So, they're sort of protected, and it's this community, so... I was like, well, that was really cool, because it's like, oh, a blind school. So they already have all this stuff in place on how right. to walk and mm-hmm. go out in the world without yeah. vision, which is what.
Now, if I did have one complaint that I would have liked to have heard explained, because whether these creatures have a physical form, whether they don't, why that you have to see them for them to hurt you. What's the explanation for why they can't enter buildings? like it seems like they can never, like they're always, oh, they can only hurt you when they're outside. They can never enter a building. Are they like vampires where they have to be invited in? Or like, if you notice, like the characters and the humans were always safe if they were in a building. Mm-hmm. Or even if they were in a car. Anything that's enclosed, the creatures couldn't get in. They were only outside. That's the only place they were throughout the entire film.
Yeah, I don't know. So Aaron... You saw this movie.
Yes, I did.
What were your thoughts on it? Overall, did you like it?
I liked it, but it would be like 50% for me. Like, there's just something missing. That's how I feel about it. I feel like...
Did you watch it blindfolded?
Yeah, that would be an experience. No, I just feel like they don't set up the rules quite well enough, because like you said, they're only
criticism.
Outside. Are they omnipresent? Like... Anytime you open your eyes, this can hit you. Well, then how are they? There can't be creatures in every reach of the earth outdoors. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
And, you know, that's a good point, too. Like Sandra Bullock, when she's coming home from the hospital and her sister is driving, and then her sister sees something and she goes nuts and, you know, crashes the car. Like, they were both looking out the windshield. Why did she see it, and why didn't Sandra Bullock?
Like, yeah, and they do an interesting at the top of the movie of sort of talking about it, and there's news reports in the background, and they sort of the setup is sort of very much talked about like it's sort of some sort of virus that's spreading. Mm-hmm. The way we've seen in other post-apocalyptic movies like World War Z.
Right.
Where you kind of, they're like, Daddy, we got to go to school. And, oh, this boy that's watching this, there's more of that outbreak happening. And that's how they talk about this. Like, it's this, it's already happened in other parts of the world.
Right.
And now it's, it might be here, but they're not sure. And so then when Sandra Bullock sees everything start going nuts at the hospital in the beginning, she goes, oh shit, it's here. She puts two and two together. People start flipping out. So then it's like, it is very vague, and it just sort of asks the viewer to just go, yeah, it's a crazy monster ghost virus smoke just that can't come indoors. Just accept it.
Yeah, when Sarah Paulson's driving, it feels as though she's looking at like something's happening to the sun or like some
right. Her eyes go dark.
But like, no, I don't mean like that. But I mean like, it's an object in the sky that she sees and Sandra Bullock can't because of her vantage point or whatever. And then everyone who else is like, what is that? And looks at it and this happens to them. Versus later, it just seems like any time you open your eyes outdoors, where no matter where you are, the forest at night, I mean, there's got to be some sort of, there just had to be more rules to it, I think.
Right.
To what it was.
Well, let me just play devil's advocate here, because I didn't have as big of a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the fact that we're literally, it's through the eyes of these like handful of survivors, and so they're like, we don't know what the fuck is happening.
Right.
To me, that was kind of part of the fun of it, was just like, there's kind of some rules, but we have no idea. And if you just were in life and this thing was happening and there was no reasonable explanation.
Right.
And you just realize, well, I guess if we tape up the windows, we're good.
Mm-hmm.
If we go outside, we got to cover our eyes. Otherwise, it's over. Right.
Until we get in the car.
Until we get in the car and we got to tape up the windows of the car.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't, you also, it infects
you. Could you wear
through
a diver's helmet?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, to me.
Let's not argue over eyewear.
Yeah.
Yeah. But to me, I was like, can't you just look down when you walk? Like,
ow.
Everyone who sees it seems to see it either in the sky or somewhere in front of them versus, I'm like, look at your feet. What are they there? Are they hovering around your sneakers?
Yeah.
And one of the rules that the dip.
They live in your shoelaces. Yeah.
But they're also, they can if infect you through social media and through your TV and through the security cameras is what, you know, happens to BD Wong. It's like, what?
Oh, right.
There's got to be some, like, I thought that would be the ultimate, like, that would be a nice bit where it's like, oh, you can go through cameras or whatever, you'd be fine.
Or like a mirror. Like,
no, it immediately.
Like
yeah, it immediately.
Like looking at Medusa through a mirror.
Yeah,
like
exactly. Give me shield. Some way these guys can get through this in a manageable way.
Well, the other thing that also made it more supernatural, speaking of like specifically what you're seeing, is that everyone's supposed to see something different. Like it's like your worst fear or your worst nightmare then causes you to kill yourself. So there isn't one view of the monster, although it's possible that they have a true form or whatever. But what you see, like when the guy brings out the drawings of like the monster, that's what it looked like to him.
Right.
But that's not necessarily what it would look like to anyone else. Or okay. It might be.
And he's one of the guys that
can see it and survive.
And he
becomes
John
a servant
Malkovich
for them.
Realize
yeah.
Who had a great character, I thought, of the, oh, he's just the dick that wants to kill him and isolate himself, but he's not wrong.
Right. No, he's not. And he paid for it by letting that guy in. He was right to not let him in.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, if the world is ending and someone shows up at your door and you do let them in, you probably would check his bag.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you've got creepy drawings of monsters and stuff. Oh. Yeah, maybe you should go back outside.
Guess what? Yeah.
Give him a firm pat down.
Yeah.
Not just a cursory.
Yeah.
But what did you think, though, of the ending, Aaron?
The ending, I was like, how long is this going to last? Like, this isn't the end. There's no way that these people all just live in harmony and there's enough food for all of them and... Where are they going to the bathroom? You know, like, Sure, it's,
well, they can make it work.
Sure.
Until they get raided
mm-hmm. by... are these crazy people who are out there who can see without blindfolds? Or are they just not hitting this place? Are they not listening to the radio to find it as well? Like, they'd have the best advantage to find this bird sanctuary, this sanctuary for the blind. Like, they would easily find it and take it over. I don't understand how that hasn't or won't happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. You know, that's, we didn't really go into a ton of details on the sanctuary, but,
And is everyone in there blind, or is...
No, it's a mix.
Yeah, we didn't really get a great idea of the ratio of
blind
original
decided.
People and other people have come.
Well, it's a
room.
Sanctuary for everyone, so it would be a mix, obviously, of sighted and non-sighted. But yeah. One of the things that the movie was really about was kind of like Sandra Bullock's journey through, you know, ultimately postpartum depression, not wanting kids, to opening herself up and, you know, living and feeling life, especially for her children at the end, because she finally gives them names at the end after they hit the sanctuary, because she's so closed off, and the fact that she just names them boy and girl. And what I liked about it too is it showed how closed off she was. Like, you could see it in the way she spoke to the children. Like, there was no compassion. Yeah. There was no warmth. Right. Like, I care enough to keep you alive, but not enough to either encourage you or make you feel loved or anything in that regard. I'm just going to keep you alive. Then my job is done.
Which they set up in the beginning when she's pregnant and kind of in denial about having a baby.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And sort of just, I'm this, you know, single woman who's an artist and have my mm-hmm. own life. And it's like, yeah, that's all going to change, kid, in about 5 months or whatever. Yeah. So get mm-hmm. ready. Mm-hmm. And even the doctor is like, the doctor's like, you better wake up to this reality. It's coming. And then, of course, we see the doctor at the end at the school for the blind,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of a neat. I actually liked that.
Oh,
I guess,
I missed that. Wow.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No.
Hey,
yeah, you're right. The girl from Bennett Like Beckham. Yeah.
Yeah. The girl from Bennett Like Beckham. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm surprised she didn't ask, "Oh, where'd you get the other kid?"
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you were bringing, there was only one in there.
So you adopted?
Yeah.
After.
Yeah.
But I guess you guys bring up all these points that I'm like, oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. I guess I got a little more just taken into the.
And that goes back to our initial discussion. Your suspension of disbelief brought you over all of those little, inconsistencies. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, you forgave them.
Because I just was like, mm-hmm. I don't know, crazy ghost monster things, can't see them.
And the other thing is, why do these ghost monsters who can't come in the door make women go into labor at the exact same time?
That's the thing. Don't look at these things. Yeah. You'll go into labor and then blow your own head off.
Yeah, so there is that as well. There's apparently some side effects of ghostly suicide monsters.
Yeah, I just sort of like, all right, cool. Let's just see the journey. And I'm glad that it wasn't all Sandra Bullock with a blindfold on, seeing just these blurry images, trying to figure that out, because that would have been boring to me.
I'll tell you.
I'm glad they did, and I like the use of the flashbacks, I guess.
Right. She's really had an interesting career, Sandra Bullock. You know, for every Bird Box and Gravity, there's like a Miss Congeniality in that resume. Like, she goes really from just...
But she got out of that. She got out of that ghetto of just like, you know, she would snort and bump into stuff and be the cute girl in the rom-com.
Yeah, she took control of her career.
She really did. Mm-hmm. And then has done, you know, some really interesting work, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, you look at like, you know, everything from, you know, Tom Hanks started in Bosom Buddies. And, look where he went after that. So it's a lesson really for actors. It's like, you know, but it doesn't happen immediately and overnight and under someone else's tutelage. You have to take control of that yourself as your career, because, you know, the truth is agents and managers, they don't care. They're just they want the biggest paycheck. If that's Miss Congeniality 5, they're going to pitch it to you as the best movie ever. Yeah. You know, if you say, I want to do Bird Box for Netflix, you know, at first, I'm like, it's not going to pay as much. And it's, you know, I don't know. Your horror is not your thing. You shouldn't be in horror movies.
Yeah,
I'm sure there was that bullshit resistance that she got. But, you know, she stuck to her guns. No, this is a good script. I want to do it. And
this last five years or so of hers, maybe even 10, is where she's really made this transition. You know, we had Blindside, we've had
Gravity,
we've had really, really good, you know, where she doesn't, and every once in a while, like she did the Melissa McCarthy buddy cop thing.
The Heat.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Which was,
one.
But that was even a somewhat of the departure, because she let Melissa McCarthy do the heavy, big comedy lifting, and she played more the straight man, which was great, actually.
She was Abbott.
And you know, it's really interesting where her career has gone, I think. And it's really, you know, this character, she did a good job.
Don't forget Demolition Man.
Chris won't let go of the 90s. It's the early 2000s with this woman.
I saw it in the theater.
So did I. I could almost wager I was on the road somewhere.
I was 11.
Yeah. That's just good parenting.
Yep.
Bringing an 11-year-old to Demolition Man.
Yeah, and, you know, especially in the VR sex with Sylvester Stallone. That was...
Hey, gotta learn somehow.
But I want to talk about too, in terms of, like, she did a fine job of acting in this. Whether your suspension disc, whether you bought that or not, her as this, you know, reluctant parent who's now thrown into a post-apocalyptic nightmare, trying to raise kids, and is really shut off emotionally, as I would imagine a person would be if they were thrown into this horror show.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is. I mean, again, you do that. You say, okay, she's shut off emotionally, but she has this relationship with a man. Which, she meets through this,
which was great, and look, that Trevante Rhodes is the actor,
and it was part of her ultimately de-thawing, really, and that's, you know, that's part of her journey. Like at first, she didn't want anything to do with him, but you know, she gradually, you know, started to start embrace life again through him, but not completely, not through the kids. Like even when she embraced life with him, it didn't go far enough. Like, they argued about the kids. It's like, you know, you've got to give them hope. And it's like, no, I'm trying to keep them alive. I'm like, it's not enough to just keep them alive. You have to give them something to live for.
It also, you know, that guy is a fantastic actor. Yeah, and, like, you look at him in Moonlight last year. He was so good as this street guy, you know, gang dude, whatever, who's also a closeted gay man. And in this, he plays just this, you know, he's a construction worker. He's talking about his team. He's, you know, he's a regular guy with a regular job who's then thrust into this thing. That's always sort of the thing with the post-apocalyptic is you take this mishmash of people and you throw them all in together.
Well, you know, I just hope the funny guy from Get Out isn't going to be the funny guy in from every horror movie. Like, he literally played the exact same character. You know,
Lil Rel Howery.
Yeah, yeah.
He's in Get Out. He's the TSA agent.
Yeah, he's the TSA agent. And, you know, it's like he's in the supermarket. Ain't no way I'm cleaning this up. And I'm like, okay, well, it's the same.
That guy's the same guy. Yeah. But I mean, I think Trevante Rhodes is somebody that I think we're just starting to scratch the surface on how good of an actor he's going to be. And I think we're going to see him in some fantastic, because he's already, these two roles, just Moonlight and this, were like pretty varied.
I mean, I've said this before and it bears repeating, especially with a movie like this, the best horror movies are treated like dramas.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have good actors treating these like dramas that just happens to have extraordinary or supernatural circumstances, but they react to them in a very grounded and realistic way. It makes everything more believable. Again, goes back to easier to suspend disbelief. Like if you had a shitty CW actress running around, you know, in a short skirt, you know, seeing monsters, nobody gives a shit.
With an awful script with two-dimensional characters and cliches, which we didn't have. We had, I mean, even the complexities of John Malkovich's character.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was like some sort of rich guy kind of lawyer who was a little bit of a dick. And so he carries that into the apocalypse, but then he's not.
And the minute we meet him, he loses his wife.
Right.
Who's helping.
The very second. Yeah.
He's helping and he's mad that he lost his wife. Like she was the Trevante Rhodes to his character. You know what I mean? Like she was obviously just from his reaction to losing his wife, she was the nice, sweet one. And he was the hard ass, just like Sandra Bullock is the hard ass to Trevante Rhodes being the sweet one with the heart.
Now, devil's advocate here, just as we're exploring the world and the rules in this world, like, and I'm sure because this is based on a book, there's probably a ton more rules and explanations in the book. Like, I'd be interested to see what would happen. Like, let's say you're with a group of people. One of them sees the monsters and is about to kill themselves. However, the other people intervene, tie this person to a bed or whatever so they can't kill themselves, does it pass? Or the second you let them up, do they try to kill themselves again?
Or do they just starve themselves?
Or they just starve, like, yeah. Like, what happens? Like,
that's if a you great question.
Them? Yeah, so it'd be, like, and that type of stuff is really interesting and fun to explore, which I'm sure, like I said, more stuff gets explored in the book. A movie you have much limited,
well,
limited
I would have liked to have seen, if you're going to say that they kill themselves because they see their greatest fear, let's flash it. Flash it on the screen. When their eyes turn, flash of what?
They tried. They tried, and they cut it out because it was Sandra Bullock. It was like a baby monster, like a monster with like a baby head, and she just kept laughing because it looked so ridiculous that they cut the.
Well, she
scene.
Wouldn't. She doesn't turn, so we wouldn't see what she's afraid of.
Well, I mean, it was a nightmare.
It's clearly the.
It was a.
The ability to love is her greatest.
Yeah.
Well, they kind of did. They kind of alluded to it at the very end when she's. She's getting close to the blind school, right? And you start to hear the voices. You hear the voices of the people that are already dead going, it's okay, come here. Like, which was interesting, but it wasn't that thing that you're talking about, Aaron, of I wish we could have seen what that guy that talked his way in that had the drawings of the monsters. Like, I wish we could have seen everybody's worst fear. Would have been really cool.
Yeah. Just, I mean, it wouldn't take any more screen time. It'd be just...
Just a flash.
A couple of flashes, maybe, and boom.
Well, I thought it was a good creative choice, actually, not to show that, because it leaves the creepiest parts up to your imagination, because I think they would have run the risk every single scene of like, all right, well, that one was creepy, but that one was dumb, and that one, yeah.
Well,
I really need
but
to
we're
see.
Human. We have stupid reasons for everything we do, and everything we're afraid
of. But, like,
of.
I like the fact that, like
if I saw the thing, they'd be like, caves? Like, he doesn't like small spaces? Yeah. That's my thing.
And it's also
good to know.
The way they killed each other, too, like, themselves, too. Like you know, Aaron saying, like, you know, caves, small spaces, that could do it. But, like, what suicidal action would that lead to? Like, Sandra Bullock's sister crashed the car. You know, John Malkovich's wife went into a burning car. And then the one old woman stabbed herself in the neck with a knife or a scissors. So it's like whatever they're seeing also kind of dictates how they kill themselves too. So which I find interesting. And also it leaves a lot of it up to your imagination. Like, what are you seeing that's causing this to happen?
Right.
I wouldn't mind if they weren't connected. It's just like the fastest, closest thing, which is kind of cool. And then it made it so you had no time to save them. You know,
right. Yeah, there's that too.
It doesn't necessarily have to correspond with their fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could be just jumping out the window.
I wouldn't run into a cave. I think I'm just saying that would be the thing.
You'd have
flash.
To find a cave first.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I'd just be running
and
through
then
the
check
hills.
Its Yelp reviews and everything.
Make sure it's right.
Exactly.
How many stars does this scary cave get?
Yeah, you'd have to go up look on Cave B&B.
Look, guys, a crawl space under a house will work. It's all, it's small, all right. And I got to crawl. No, thanks.
So let's move on to Roma.
We talked pretty extensively,
yes,
on the regular episode about Roma, and it is again, it is such beautiful. Alfonso Cuarón and he won best foreign and best picture in the Golden Globes, which I think is an indication how the Oscars are going to go, as well it should be, because I have yet, and there's a couple more Oscar-y movies I need to see. But there's nothing that's coming close to this film.
Well, no, Critics' Choice happened this weekend. He won Best Picture, Best Foreign Film, and Best Director.
Wow.
And maybe cinematography as well.
I think he's going to sweep that at every awards ceremony.
Yeah. And it's also like, it's not every year that a movie might be up for Best Picture and Best Foreign Film at the same time at the Academy Awards. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, they kind of go hand in hand with a movie like that. I mean, it's a real possibility to win Best Director and Best Cinematographer, too, which is unusually the same guy. Like, normally it's not the same guy, but this time it is. So let's talk about Roma. I wouldn't want to get into the ending too much because it was a non-spoiler episode, but I want to talk about that scene on the beach, which was so heartbreaking and terrifying, because I really thought, as I'm watching this movie, that, all right, well, this is where the tragedy is going to happen. These kids are going to drown. And just the fact that she's afraid of the water, she goes back in and gets the kids. And I thought, okay, well, she saved one, but then the other one's going to drown. Like, I immediately thought, there's no way these kids are going to get saved.
And let's go, well, let's talk about that in terms of his view as a director and a cinematographer.
Yes.
We only see her.
Yes.
They tracked her. She's terrified. She starts going into the water.
Right.
Fact of fact, we know she can't swim. It doesn't pan out to see where the kids are. Doesn't see what she's looking at.
It stays on her.
It just stays on her. So you're like, where are the kids? They kind of float in and out of frame. You see what I'm going, and then they kind of go underwater, and you're like fucking terrified.
And also, the way that scene was shot, it puts you in the water with them. There were no cutaways. You literally, you start on the beach, you go in the water with her to look for the kids, and then you come back out. So logistically, I was just thinking, that had to be like a guy in a Steadicam walking back and forth, you know, with her.
And this goes back to the thing we were talking about in the regular episode of how the sound design, the sound mix, how that was so important in telling the story. And we talked about one of the reasons why you got to see it in the big screen.
Right.
Like, you're sitting in the theater and you'd hear like people arguing in the room next door. And so on the left speaker over your shoulder, you'd hear this muffle argument.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So when we get to the beach, I'm in the theater and the sound is the, and I was like, God, this guy, I'm a beach guy and I hear and feel all of the sounds of the beach when I'm down there. So I was like, he's capturing it.
Mm-hmm.
The nice breeze, the seagulls flying, you know, the kids laughing in the background. And then when the kids are drowning and she goes to the water, the sound of the ocean gets so loud, it becomes terrifying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you're now as scared as she would be if I can't swim and I've got to jump. And I've been in Big Surf and it can be fucking terrifying.
Yeah,
and I'm a very good swimmer. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine. So I was like shaking and scared because of the sound.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful filmmaking.
Right.
It's just like, it was so like, and I'm like, holy shit.
Well, I will say this as a parent too. As soon as I hear, we want to go in the water. All right, but just in the shallow part. Okay. You know that's never,
The kids are never gonna
work.
Do that.
Yeah,
just stay where I can
work.
See you.
Yeah,
they're 200 yards down the dam.
Nope.
My nephews did that. I almost dragged them out of the water by their ears.
Yeah. That's like, oh, I wonder what's gonna happen there. So it was really powerful and effective. And the whole movie was leading up to that emotional moment. But what's fascinating is you didn't know it at the time. You didn't know that the whole movie was leading up to that really strong emotional moment, but it did, and it did it in a very organic and almost like unusual and almost, I don't know, I'm looking at the word I'm thinking of, like almost like a misdirection. Like you didn't know really where the movie was going, but then when we get there, you're like, oh, we were kind of leading up to this the entire time.
It makes... Yeah, you think, are the kids going to drown? Is she going to drown trying to save them? She rescues the kids. The mom runs up. The kid says, hey, you know, she saved the daughter and the mom. And then there's that scene that's...
And that's actually the movie poster.
That's the movie poster. They're all hugging in a huddle on the beach. That's the family. That's the... And then she says, and we're going to get into this, the hospital scene, because her baby is stillborn.
Right.
We're going to talk about that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ.
That was a tough scene
to watch. That's a tough scene to watch, but also amazing filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And they're crying on the beach. So it's like they all just went through this very scary thing. Which when you that happens, it's why he's such a good filmmaker. It's such a human response. When people go through a life... A brush with death, whatever, very much have this life-affirming. People feel this need to just, like, speak really honestly and clearly and confide stuff. And she starts crying and says, I was glad the baby died. I didn't want to have this baby. And you're just like, oh.
Yeah.
So much is led up to her getting pregnant, the boyfriend that you think is a good guy that ends up being a real fucking asshole.
Right.
And we find out through, and this was stuff that was said through Perla, who gave us the information that it was showing that this kid was recruited to join this like special forces unit that was helping, you know, attack students who were protesting and all this. So when she has that realization on the beach, I mean, it's like unbelievable. I just broke down. I mean, it was like such powerful filmmaking.
And it really is also shows you, too, like how non-binary we are. Like, it's not black or white. It's not one or zero. Like, this is the woman who said she didn't really want the baby, but she was completely brokenhearted at the sight of her stillborn baby.
Who wouldn't be?
So it's the kind of thing where she says she didn't really want the baby, but at the same time, you know, a part of her really did. And that's one of the amazing thing about this film is that it shows the different sides to humanity, what somebody may say, what somebody may feel, and they don't necessarily always match up 100%. But that's the way human beings are.
Oh, yeah, that's such a great point, because had the child been born, I'm sure she would have loved and held and, oh, my God, this is so amazing. And part of her would have gone, oh, God.
Yeah.
How am I going to pay for this and take care of this? And what am
I? If I lose my job with this rich family, we're both going to be out on the street.
What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And I want to protect this child, but man, I wish it maybe wasn't here. I mean, like,
yeah,
what a human emotion for anyone to feel. Any parent, I'm sure, has gone, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And has had moments where they went, man, if we didn't have kids, it would be, you know, and
we'd have both have new cars.
Yeah, we whatever we would we could just pick up and go do this thing, you know. And then there's the moments of, oh my God, how beautiful this child is. I'm so glad they're in my life. And so I want to.
I'd be so miserable if I didn't have kids. You know, it goes for sure. I mean, all of those feelings are natural and valid. And, you know, we're so ingrained to like be ashamed of any type of negative thought or emotion, you know, when it comes to having our children. That, but the truth is everyone has them.
Everyone has
them. Yeah. And, you know, to see that on film, where it was a, you know, it was a very conflicted feeling about it, is especially after you've lost a child and stillborn, it's totally natural. And it's also a coping mechanism. Like, you know, you lost your child. How, there's nothing more heartbreaking than that. You know, it also helps you deal with it if you say, like, well, I, you know, I'm never really wanted or I'm glad it was the, this is for the best, because it's too much to handle. It's how you have to have a coping mechanism of dealing with it, and
that coping mechanism also comes with a huge amount of guilt.
Yes,
for feeling that way.
Yeah, it does. It totally does. And you know, it's a thousand different emotions going through you. And it went through her in the film. And the thing about this film and that moment is a great example. It all felt genuine and real. You know, we didn't grow up in Mexico in the turmoil in the 70s. But again, the magic of filmmaking, we can connect with the human emotions that people go through no matter where or when you went through these things.
Yeah. So he...
And that's the whole point, is connecting to the emotions.
It's connecting to the emotions. Mm-hmm. So one of the things he did, he shot on location in Mexico City. He did not use a soundstage. He could have used a soundstage, which is why we said there's all these airplanes in it, because there's airplanes flying over. But let's the delivery scene in the hospital, which is one of the just like, I just was like, oh.
Yeah.
Like,
and also show you the separation of class, where if she didn't have a rich benefactor, she would have been like literally in the basement with 1,000 other moms giving birth with no help. Mm-hmm.
She got the good health care with the good doctors because she works for a doctor family.
Yes.
So he's a doctor and they have and the wife, they got money and he's got respect.
Right.
She's immediately brought to the front of the line.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, they get to that hospital after the riots, right? So there's the riots where they shot the kids and which again was so, and the sound design, you felt like, holy shit, I'm in a city where there is a riot happening. Yes. You hear gunfire off in the background. You hear stuff happening right here. You see people crying because somebody got shot. It's insane. Then you get to this massive hospital in this huge city, and it is bedlam.
Right.
There are hundreds of people wounded, crying.
It's chaos.
Ma'am, you got to wait in this long line. Walks right to the front.
Right.
The grandmother says, no. And this, you know, rich... You know, grandmother, older matriarch says, and that, taken care of.
You know, what's interesting too, is like, you always look at Mexico and the initial impression is always, well, it's a poor country. Everyone's poor in Mexico. I'm like, not everyone.
Nope.
You know, no, that's
every
not.
Every country
that's,
has that, rich
that's
people.
That's not the case. And it showed you like, oh yeah, there is another class to, you know, to Mexico.
The
and
rich people in Mexico don't need to, they don't come to this country.
No.
Because they have a good life.
Yeah.
They don't need to leave their nice villas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, they have a car that can't fit in their driveway. Yeah.
So then that scene, this piece of information will say several things. One, why he's such a great filmmaker and why the scene is so powerful. So the hospital scene was shot only once. The doctors and nurses were real and they were not actors, and they were hired to make the scene feel more authentic.
And it did.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. And it's that typical thing. He just keeps it on her and right. everything that's mm-hmm. around her. So
weren't 1,000 cuts in this movie.
No.
Yeah.
And those are so powerful because you're just there watching everything that's happening on this mm-hmm. in the frame.
Right.
You're not being diverted to this right. cutaway and that yeah. cutaway.
Close up, you know, two shot.
Two shot.
And like, no, here's the camera's locked down. Here's everything happening in the frame. You could look wherever you want, but here's the action happening throughout this entire area.
And that's what he does. He mm-hmm. actually kind of gives you, the viewer, the mm-hmm. option of what to cut to because right. he puts so much in the frame.
Yes.
Do I look at the anesthesiologist in the corner of the frame right. that's doing? And then again, with the sound, and because it makes so much sense, he hires these real actors. So you're hearing this like, and it's in Spanish. You know, they're basically like, you know, get her EKG, blood vitals, and it's just yeah. fucking crazy. And it starts out, oh, we've delivered 1 million babies. You'll be fine. Okay, wait. All right. You know, this isn't that great. Let's get her out of here. Let's get her into this room. You feel and hear their urgency go up in the medical staff.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you then, you're her. You're watching. You're the woman like... If everyone's like, okay, sweetie, we've delivered 1 million babies. I know you're mm-hmm. nervous. Don't worry about this. And then my voice kind of changes to, okay, you know what? We need to move her to this room, get the doctor on right. call. We need the surgeon mm-hmm. there. You'd go, oh, shit. And that's what I was doing as the audience. And again, the frame is full with all of the chaos. Mm-hmm. The sound is full. So I am just like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
Is the baby, what's going to happen with the baby? That's what she's going through. Where's my baby? It's the baby. And then the baby's dead.
Yeah, stillborn.
And she says, can I hold it? It's just, it's unbelievable human.
And it wasn't CG either. That was a prop baby.
Yeah, it was.
Which made it. They created it.
They had, if you put CG in a black and white period piece, you would have ruined it.
It wouldn't have looked right.
You would have taken everyone out of the theater.
With all the technology we have, it still wouldn't have looked right. Practical effect was the way to go for sure.
And, you know, it was dedicated to Lebo, who was his family servant and the central character was based on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing. So Kurian was the only person on set to know the entire script and the direction of the film. Each day before filming, the director would hand the lines to the cast, attempting to elicit real emotion and shock from his actors. Each actor would also receive contradictory directions and explanations, which meant there was chaos on the set every day. For Kurian, that's exactly what life is like. It's chaotic, and you can't really plan how you react to any given situation, which is what made it so authentic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's not all these big-name bankable stars in there.
No.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of these people are actors in Mexico and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but...
I didn't recognize anyone.
She's a newcomer.
But that was the kind of... That was the point.
That was the point.
Yeah.
This is just Mexico City in 1970.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With the, you know, Mexico City has a massive pop. It's like, I don't know, 30 million people or something crazy like that. And it felt so, and then when it felt just like regular everyday life in the beginning. And then when all this shit started to slowly kind of unravel in politically in the town, and then also within the family, when the husband, we reveal later, see, I thought it was a pretty good slow reveal. The husband leaves, and I thought we were going to see him. The reason he's delayed in coming back is because he's caught up in this political turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out he's actually having an affair.
Right.
Which was also good
mm-hmm.
because I'm sure that's...
We never saw any shots of him after he left the house because...
We saw one shot when he's at the movie theater with his mistress.
Oh, I don't remember that
yeah.
scene.
Yeah. Okay. She sees it. The housekeeper sees it.
Oh, because the housekeeper's okay. I forgot about that.
And it's like,
yeah,
wait,
yeah.
huh? What? Mm-hmm. And it's like she has to kind of play dumb.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then we hear the conversations of the wife crying on the phone, and he's with his lady, and you know, right. all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And 90% of the scenes represented in the film are scenes taken out of his memory.
Right.
Which is why, again, they feel so authentic. And mm-hmm. then he shoots it, stages it, and keeping the actors in the dark, so they just show up, because that's what would happen. Oh, I'm just showing up to work today. It's a regular day. Oh, yeah. Shit, there's a revolution. Oh, shit, you know, yep. like...
Well, in a way, the actors, they didn't have any homework. It was like, all right, well, there's no sides to study. We won't know until we get on set what's going to happen.
I would actually love that as an actor, because then you could really, you know, the improvisational style, it's what lent this to being such a powerful movie. I mean, it's really just, I mean, this has to be, you got to put this in the top 100 movies of all time. It is the best movie of the year, without a doubt. I mean, nothing can come close to it. It is, I have never, it's one of those few movies, this handful of movies, I'd put it in the top 20 of all time, where you had a sincere, emotional, physical, emotional response.
Right.
When the movie's over, you know, for me, I know it's a good movie. When the credits are rolling and I'm sitting in my seat going,
you're a little exhausted.
Oh,
yeah. yeah. You're
whoa.
Spent.
Mm-hmm. And it was so... It was so amazing and powerful. I can't, that hospital scene and then the scene at the beach.
I mean, it was just great filmmaking all around, and it was personal. And I mean, everything kind of came together. And it was also, you know, a filmmaker making the movie the way he wanted to make it. It was his vision. Like, you know, how are you going to note a movie like this? There's no way you can.
What are you going to say?
Yeah, yeah. What would the notes look like on a movie like this?
Yeah, you know,
less
we just
planes.
We
just,
more cutaways.
Yeah.
More jump cuts.
Yeah.
Not so many tracking shots that yeah. captured everyday life in Mexico City.
And can we set it in the 80s? Yeah.
I mean, all of this stuff, man. Just yeah, it's one of those pieces of cinema that like 10 years from now, if they're playing it on a big screen, I'm going to go watch it.
Right.
It's like I still, if I can, when movies like Godfather are playing and it's a 35mm print or something like that, if I can go see it, I will.
We saw Lawrence of Arabia. I remember that in the Dome Theater. And
yep.
It was unbelievable experience.
I think we were at that same screening.
Yeah, I think we might have been.
And
yeah.
we all went, oh, my God. I had already seen Apocalypse Now several times on VHS as a kid because, and then when it, I remember seeing it at the Cinerama Dome here in LA.
Did you see the crazy long director's cut?
I saw all of them.
Oh, you saw all of them? Okay.
I saw a redo and I saw, I remember sitting in the Cinerama Dome when they showed the regular version, not the crazy director's cut. And again, they did that same thing of hearing the helicopters flew over my head.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, you just put me into this thing.
Right.
And it's like, I remember seeing when they re-released Godfather, I saw it at the Chinese theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched Godfather 1 and 2, and I remember walking out of there with some people from my acting class, and I was like, that movie is seamless.
Right.
It's seamless. There's not, and that's what Roma is.
Right.
There's no like, well, that scene was all right, or that actor was decent, or that dialogue felt a little clunky. No, man, it's just like... And this is when a filmmaker captures something this personal. So you could just say, this is good filmmaking because it's also like, it's not Hollywood's interpretation of Mexico from the 70s.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Hollywood's interpretation of Mexico is probably pretty inaccurate even today and pretty racist, I would imagine. You know, everyone's poor. You know, everyone's brown, everyone, you know, whatever. Nope. We got to see the whole authentic class structure from a guy that lived there during the time. And then to also be enough of a visual expert and know how to visually convey these scenes that were, like you said, 90% of them actually happened. So, and to show them to us so that we feel like we get them the way he got them when he was they were happening to him.
And just the trucker tracking shots, you know, of the city blocks that are all bustling with activity. It's like, first of all, it's a period piece, so you got to set it for the 70s. Then, as we're going past, it's everything from cars to costumes to storefronts. Everything has to look like it was from the 70s. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if that's where some computer aid, some computer effects happened, but it looks great, and it looks very, like, there was. I'm sure there was a lot of practical, you know, set design and production design there as well. But it was just incredible. Like, it felt like, you know, some of these tracking shots almost felt like documentaries. Like, you're just watching something happening. Like, you know, you're seeing our leads walk past, but there's so much activity going on throughout the entire frame that you're like, well, God, this is, you know, every one of those gets stage direction and is an actor, and they have you know, something to do as we're walking by and seeing them for 2 seconds. So it makes it all feel so authentic and real. So
the amount of research that must have been done to to, as you say, pack those frames. I mean, this is Mexico City. This is a huge city.
Yeah.
How the hell did you shut down these streets and then set dress them for 1970? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's an immense undertaking, to where, like you say, I felt like I was watching a documentary of Mexico City from the 70s.
You know, and there's a lot of movie magic going on as to how these shots were obtained. And, you know, a lot of it, you know, if you're just watching it as a viewer, we're a little more cognizant of it because we know what it's like to get some of these shots and like how difficult it is, especially like the one in the water. I'm thinking that's either a guy in a Steadicam, that's somebody on a platform, you know, walking with a Steadicam, that's, you know, that's a crane, that's, you know, I'm going through all my head, a drone, maybe there's all different ways that shot could have been gotten. But at the same time, whatever he picked the right thing, because it looked amazing. And that's one of the beautiful things about the filmmaking in this movie, is that every creative choice, from the technical to the content to the creative, was, I felt like, the right decision. Like, with the exception of the 10-minute long naked martial arts scene, I thought that could have been cut in half, but we already had that discussion.
I didn't mind that scene.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, I get the point. Oh, we're still going. Okay.
And again, though, like I said, the point of that scene was to show this guy as a little out there and a little dangerous and...
And I felt like, well, let's just finish out the reel of film. Let's keep going. I know it was shot digitally, but let's just pretend it's film and let's just keep going.
And also, I saw that and I went, because, you know, you ask yourself, well, why would she be with such an? I get it. The guy was in great shape. You know, he's swinging his sword around.
I mean, and also, you know, she's a housekeeper, and they made a point of, like, you know, her options may be limited for who's going to be with her. And that point was made a couple of times, specifically to her, with him when he liked her, with him when he walked on her, and when she confronted him. It was made again. Like, you know, you're a servant. You know, get away from me.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't even matter that you were pregnant. This is my child. This is what you are. And this is your station, and you're beneath me.
Which is also that scene, which is really heartbreaking. And, of course, she's so... This actress does such a great job of just, like, she's very stoic, but you can see how hurt she is.
Yeah, of course.
Without this big emoting of it. Mm-hmm. And so...
It was hard for her to track him down.
Oh, she tracks him down, and then when he says that, and he's such a dick to her, right? And that scene, she doesn't have this big breakdown. She doesn't cry. Mm-hmm. So then that informs when we get to the beach and she finally says that, you know, that's part of it. She feels like she's less than, you know, whatever. This guy was an asshole to her. Maybe I am just a servant. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have this baby. So when she makes that admission.
It'll remind me of him every time.
Again,
a whole nother perspective of just that line and what she's feeling. Because, you know, there's more than it's better. I didn't want to have that baby. You know, there's more there.
It's not just money so much. And then... The revealing of it, that moment of honesty with the family at the beach at the end of the movie, is all of those.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was an asshole. I really liked him. He treated me like shit. Does that, when somebody treats you like shit that way, part of you goes, did I deserve it? Am I shitty? Was this supposed to happen? Maybe I am just a dumb servant. You know, like I'm all of that was there when she had that emotional reaction at the beach.
Right.
And then after the beach, when she's just like back to her regular life, you know, making the thing and the mom gets the smaller car and the, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All that can fit in the driveway.
They can fit in the driveway, which is sort of like a fuck you to the dad.
Yeah. And the dogs just seem to shit all the time. No one can seem to keep up with the dog shit.
Dogs shit 10 times a day, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. And even with two servants in the house, it's impossible to keep up with.
Keep up with the dog shit. But yeah, and then the end of the movie kind of goes back to the beginning of just sort of this simple daily life of you know, doing the dishes and the chores and the thing. And,
You know, and that the dog shit is, of course, a metaphor for like, you know, for a number of things. One of them that no matter how much you clean it up, there's still going to be more shit the next day.
There's always more dog shit the next day.
And, you know, it's a Herculean task. It doesn't matter. It's always going to be more. And you'll never get in front of it or a hold of it. But
that's why I don't own a dog.
Yeah, there's that way to do it. Yeah, not have a dog.
I can't sing the praises of this movie enough.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
It's definitely worth seeing. Like, but here's the great thing about this movie too. We talk about the limited availability of seeing these films. Like, it's probably not in the theater near you. However, if you have Netflix, you can see it. It's a great alternative. Like what if all of these movies that are at the Golden Globes are nominated for awards, what if we could see them streaming at somebody? Even if we had to pay for them, that's fine. Make them all on demand before these awards shows so everyone can see them. But, you know, we had the discussion in the regular episode, but it bears repeating because they haven't caught on with it yet. Uh-huh. You know, I think the streaming companies are going to make them, these old school studios, catch on that, like, you know, oh, guess what movies are available for award season that people are able to see whenever they want and often streaming without an extra fee. The movies that we make. What about the movies that you make? Oh, people can't see them. Nice work.
I know. It's like, it's, and this movie, God, you got to see it on the big screen. You got to see it in a theater with the lights off. You got to do that.
Well, it's also possible, and a small amount of movies get this, they get re-released, like after they've already had their qualifying run, or they've been in the theaters and they're out. They'll come back. Not every movie gets this treatment, but the ones that the studios are very confident on award winners, they'll get re-released. So, but again, not all of them. You know, you still won't be able to catch all of them. So, you know, we got to take what we can get for now until the studios get into this century and understand that people need to see these movies before their dumb award shows.
Well, guys,
Oh, the Patreon sponsors. I almost forgot. Thank you.
Please go to patreon.com/comedyfilmnerds.
You're on every episode, guys.
Yep, for $50 a month, we will read your things as we are about to do now. And you're really helping support the show.
We almost got 7 angry emails.
That sounds like a Western.
Yeah. Johnny Rulon has his novel Green Cheek, A Junkie's Guide to Street Magic. It's on Amazon, both digital and hard copy. It's an experimental stream of consciousness novel.
Which
follows the exploits of the muse Calliope and her mortal lover T.S. on a journey through time, dreams, and the hidden places of a supernatural America.
Calliope.
The website is happyhorrorshowproductions.com, happyhorrorshowproductions.com. And the Audacity Performing Arts Project produces after-school performing arts projects in poor, underfunded, and low-performing schools. Performing arts education is not a luxury. Please visit them at audacityperformingarts.com. That's audacityperformingarts.com.
Performing arts.
Chris Parker Howard, Coffee Over Suicide, a dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time.
Suicide.
Get caught up on season one now for the season 2 premiere of February of 2019 or wherever podcasts are found. More at coffeeoversuicide.com. And Alice Frazier, co-host of the Bugle podcast and Tea with Alice, brings you a series of 3 genre-bending solo stand-up shows that explore the boundary between comedy and tragedy.
Hot tea!
Yeah, they were recorded back-to-back as a 3-hour show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival with a binaural microphone, which creates an intensely immersive listening experience. AliceFrazier.com. AliceFrazier.com.
Binaural.
That's a good one. I like binaural. Rebecca Evans, The Art Podcast. When we move past hesitation, we're true to ourselves, we find our own art in life. You want to hear some fun stories and get inspired? Check out The Art at facebook.com/TheArtPodcasts with an S.
Check out The Art.
La Calavera by Alan Ross, the story of a pirate radio operator decides to go into the pirate cable TV business. Darren Loney, together with a group of misfits and the questionable guidance of a spiritual advisor in the form of Richard Nixon, gear up to take on the world's largest media conglomerate and its egomaniacal celebrity CEO. It's on Amazon in ebook and hard copy.
I'm not a crook.
Yeah. And Dave Hynek, a composer of contemporary classical music that people actually like, davidhynek.com, H-E-I-N-I-C-K. Boom. Thank you, Patronies.
Classical music. Mm-hmm. Check them out, guys. Support the, so another thing is to support these Patreon. Go to their websites and check this thing out, because then, and let them know that you heard about it through us.
Yes.
So that then tells them that their marketing money that they're spending with us is worth
it. Well spent.
Is working. Mm-hmm. So guys, that's Spoiler Up 90, Bird Box and Roma. Love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yep. Check out the message boards or tweet at us, any of those things.
And see Rome on a big screen.
Yeah.
Do yourself that favor. It is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to see it again on a big screen. So thank you so much, Aaron Brungart, for working the podcast ones and twos.
Can you guys tell which movie I saw?
Yeah. So I hope you had your ears plugged for the Romo talk.
I record so many podcasts and listen in my free time, I can't remember anything.
Oh,
so,
great.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Cool.
My brain is Swiss cheese.
Well, go see it on a big screen.
Put that on a resume.
Yeah. My brain is Swiss cheese. I don't remember well. Those are my skills. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, guys.
Typing 48 words a minute.
That's... all my tour dates are at grahamelwood.com. End of February, I will be working at the three different Zanies in the Chicago area, St. Charles, Illinois, downtown Chicago, and Rosemont. And then, of course, Progressive Comedy Tour. Ron Placone and I, we are just in Florida. Thanks to everybody that came out. In March, we will be doing the Gulf States. We're doing Lafayette, Louisiana, Oxford, Mississippi, a state I've never been to. This is my first time ever going to Mississippi, and New Orleans and Pensacola. And then in April, we are going to Texas. We're going to San Antonio, Fort Worth, Houston, and Austin. We're going all over the Lone Star State, so come on out to those shows. And in May, we are going to Salt Lake City and Boise. Go to grahamelwood.com for all of my tour dates. Come visit me on the road.
Progressive, coming to a city near you.
Mm-hmm. Hot progressive comedy.
And my graphic novel, Long Ago and Far Away, is still available at the Comedy Film Nerd store. I will sign it for you. It is... No, the coupon's gone. We stopped the 20% off coupon, so it's $24.99, but still worth it. I will sign it and ship it out. And also, Conversations from the Abyss, check it out. The new episode dropped on the 15th. New episodes every 2 weeks, starring people you know. We'll have the Sklar brothers coming up, people from Thrilling Adventure Hour. Graham Elwood and Rick Overton are on an episode coming up with a little bit of a political slant you will enjoy. So check it out with the other podcasts on iTunes, Conversations from the Abyss.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We love doing the show. Thank you, Aaron. My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first.